This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, how many times have you wished you could just quickly ask your doctor that one burning health question that you have without going through a mass of red tape or playing telephone tag? Well, in this day of electronic communications, your wish may be coming true. And here with more on this are Dr. Jennifer Christner, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and the Associate Dean for Curriculum, and Dr. Neil Seidberg, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and the Chief Medical Informatics Officer, both from Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in. So, Dr. Christner, I want to start with you. I know that you've studied that there are quicker and more convenient ways for patients to communicate with their doctor. Help us understand what those ways are.
Sure. So how this all got started was just in my own practice with adolescent patients. Many of my patients wanted to email me. And so as I would email them back frequently and we'd have conversations that way. And then as I started to talk to other colleagues and look at this, I found out that many of my colleagues were emailing their patients. And then I realized we have students and residents who patients are going to be emailing them or texting them, and that we really needed to teach our medical students and residents also about how to communicate with patients in an electronic format.
Now, this was taking place not while you were here at Upstate, am I correct?
That's correct.
At your prior location.
Mm-hmm.
Was that routinely happening, do you think, and where was that?
Mm-hmm. So I was at the University of Michigan, and I definitely can say that many of my colleagues in my specialty and other specialties would email patients or would text patients. So yes, it was definitely happening. And if you look at national data, and again, this is at that time. Now I think there's better ways and different ways that people are communicating with their physicians besides the telephone. But email was kind of the most popular back then.
So what did you study, though? You said you did a study. What did you study? What did you find?
Yeah, so first what we did was we looked at what's the best way to teach medical students to communicate electronically with patients. And then we also looked at what do parents think of electronic communication with their doctors. What they liked, what they didn't like. We actually had them read sample emails to kind of basically help us develop a good curriculum for how to teach this kind of communication.
And so hopefully some standards, parameters,
correct,
or what have you, that, because it seems to me right there is a potential Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you just say, okay, any doctor can just write emails to their patients and back again without any kind of standard, it would seem to me you could potentially run into all kinds of potential miscommunication.
You can, but you can do that with oral communication as well. And so I think that that's something that people tend to forget. And there actually are some white papers and guidelines on how to conduct yourself when you're doing electronic communication. But oral communication has plenty of areas for mistakes or insulting people or not giving them all the information. So I don't see it as there's some different ways to do it electronically, and I'm sure many of us have made those kind of goofs before on an email, but you can do them in person as well. So to me, it's just another type of communication.
So what did you actually conclude from your studies?
Yeah. So what we've really found out is that parents, because I'm a pediatrician, so we looked at parents, loved having easy access to their physicians and not having to wait for telephone calls or play phone tag. So they loved that. They loved it when the information was actually pretty short and sweet. They weren't looking. I think that what we found, I think a lot of doctors worry, well, what if they don't understand what I'm going to say or how much do I have to explain? And I think, not all, but many of our patients, are pretty reasonable people. They understand you're not going to write a big diatribe to them, and they actually don't want that. They want some short and sweet information about the question that they have, and they're also pretty savvy and pretty aware that if it can't easily be answered in email, it's probably not an email discussion and they need to come into the office.
So how about things like, basically you would say the major benefit was access?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and how about the issue of building relationship? How did that play a role?
So I can speak for me and for the parents that we interviewed in our focus groups. They felt it added quite positively to the relationship. So, and again, there were some patients that I emailed back and forth with for years, and, we could do a couple sentences, and just like you do when you have a conversation face-to-face and you get to know somebody, and that's a different kind of conversation, quote-unquote, on an email than if you have a brand-new patient, you're just getting to know them, you're going to act differently. Again, I don't think that's much different than what you would do in person than what you do in email.
So what did you see as the major stumbling block or the major factors that one would have to perhaps be concerned about?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the issue is definitely how your email is kind of worded. So parents liked it if they were organized. Parents liked it if they didn't want particularly sensitive or shocking information to be delivered via an email, but you know, quick answers is what they wanted, and good grammar. It was interesting how many of them said good grammar. I think just another really interesting thing is when we were teaching this to students, we would say, make sure you start off with some sort of empathetic statement. You know, I'm sorry that you feel this way, or I wish I could. And what our parents said resoundingly over and over again was that sounded very patronizing to them, and that they didn't appreciate those kind of statements. And just, you know, tell us what the deal is. Answer our question. You don't need to give us this big paragraph about with all these kind of softer remarks. Which
I'm
is
just curious what your random sampling of parents was. Yeah. Were these people of, let's say, a certain socioeconomic group? Was it with regard to certain education level?
Yeah. So what we did was we tried to get patients. We advertised at all of our clinics, which would grab every socioeconomic group. And we had a pretty broad range of socioeconomic groups represented. The one thing that we did have a little bit more represented is we had a patient and family group there. So parents who had kids with chronic medical problems. And so they were overrepresented in our group just because they were easy access and had a strong interest in this topic. But socioeconomic-wise, it was fairly distributed.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Drs. Jennifer Christner and Dr. Neil Seidberg, and we are talking about email patient-doctor communications. So did you notice, or in your experience so far, and I'm going to get to you, Dr. Seidberg, in just one sec, did these kinds of email or facile way of communicating generate additional emails? In other words, did it become the kind of thing that could be a back and forth, back and forth, back and forth?
I think it depends on the physician and the patient. So most of the time what we do and what most of the physicians did, there was parameters for email communication. So for example, when I was going to give someone my email, I had a little spiel, and some people actually had it written down. I'd say, don't ever use email for an emergency. I may not be able to get to it for a week if I'm out of town. So if this is an emergency, it's an inappropriate way to communicate. And I would, you know, kind of explain, if there's something that I think we can't address in email, I'm going to say you need to come in, or I'm going to give you a call. And so I think that I think during my 6 years of doing this, I don't actually think I had any patients abuse that. And I think most of my colleagues felt the same way.
But how about frequency of communication?
Frequency.
In other words, when you open that door, could it become a floodgate?
I didn't find it. So I gave my email to almost every patient, and very few took advantage of it.
Well, getting now to you, Dr. Seidberg, I understand that right now here at Upstate there is an effort to engage in something like this, not exactly like this. Tell us about it, this MyChart.
So we have been implementing a next generation electronic medical record in our hospital. And as a part of doing that, we looked at electronic communications. As you've heard, it's something that is growing in demand. Patients want to do it. They want easy access to their physicians' offices. But we wanted to do it in a way that was more secure than just a standard email. And we've implemented in this area a system called MyChart. And what MyChart is a safe system that allows folks to communicate in with their physicians' offices. And they can do anything from ask a question, request a refill, request an appointment, but it's done within our electronic medical record, so it's the information about the patient isn't leaving our system and isn't going out where it's potentially vulnerable.
I guess that was one of the questions I had for you, Dr. Christner, is that with all of the HIPAA regulations, even though the information is technically owned by the patient, when you're out there in cyberspace, everyone knows that information really is available to anyone who might want to hack it and gain access to it for all kinds of nefarious purposes. What's your feeling about that?
Yeah, so I think this was before we actually had an EMR, so actually I'm very much in favor of being able to do this in an EMR way. However, again, I think that we don't give patients enough credit in that, you know, again, we'd have a conversation. They understand what email is. They understand it can't always be secure, and they wouldn't be emailing about things that they frankly wouldn't be comfortable if they weren't on the front page of the paper. So I think we have to give patients some credit for what they're willing to put in email and what they're not willing to put in email.
What's happening these days, though, also, there's a big push along along the lines of what Dr. Seidberg was talking about, is to have patients have access to all of their medical information through things like patient portals, what have you. Part of that is also their laboratory data. And I know of late there's been talk, both at a federal level and even on a New York State level, of allowing patients to gain access to their lab results, even biopsy results, it's my understanding, in some cases even prior to a doctor, their own doctor, having a chance to look at these results and then communicate them. What's your feeling about that, Dr. Seidberg?
Well, this is something that we struggled with from the very beginning. A lot of physicians were initially concerned about this. Our system allows the physician 3 business days to go through and see the lab results before the release to the patient. In addition, we hold back certain lab results that might result in, for example, a cancer diagnosis. So certain radiological studies, certain pathology studies, we hold back for 2 weeks to give the physician time to bring patients in. What we have found since releasing our system is that the patients report back that they love getting the results. They know they don't have to wait a week for an office to get back to them. They can get them in a reasonable amount of time. And we also provide information up front just to make it clear to them that, you know, the numbers you're seeing are just numbers. They may not mean anything by themselves. If there's any question, please contact your physician for more information. The other thing that our system allows us to do is to push out teaching material to a patient. So not only do they get their lab information, but our physicians can actually push out to them information about what it means and how they might interact with it or interpret things.
So, if, for example, if they have a very high cholesterol or a high LDL, the bad cholesterol, that maybe there might be even some dietary recommendations or something of that nature?
The system allows us to put out dietary recommendations. It allows us to put out information on lifestyle changes that might help them. And with some of the recent changes that we've put in place, we'll shortly be able to get information back from the patient. So, for example, patients with high blood pressure, I'll be able to ask them simple questions like, tell me what your blood pressure is every night at 8 o'clock, and that information will come back directly into our system so that we can use it to help modify and their behavior, modify their treatment, and to continue this two-way conversation that we're having.
What about the kind of the human content that is missing when you can't actually either listen to someone's voice or see their expression when it comes to trying to read what it is a patient is trying to determine? Do you see any, Dr. Christner, any pitfalls there?
Yeah, so I think again that there can be pitfalls there, and we talk about that when we, you know, try to educate students about how to do this. However, I think, to be honest, when I look at my kids who communicate a lot electronically, I think that some of these issues may not be as prevalent or as concerning as, you know, as time goes on, because we're in an electronic age and that's how people communicate.
But there are pitfalls there. I mean, we're talking about social media. People are running amok in some ways.
Yeah.
I think accessibility seems to me, and readiness of accessibility seems to be clearly the greatest asset. But this issue of interpreting data and understanding how people feel potentially runs some risk. And how about security? Mm-hmm. I mean, in what you're describing, Dr. Seidberg, there is the security. But in a standard email, would you worry in general about that?
So again, I think it depends on the patient. Would I give a cancer diagnosis over email? No. But for example, when I had a patient and they wanted to know what their iron level was, if they were okay getting that on email, so was I.
Well, all I can say is, given the nature of physician schedules today, I don't know about doctors also having to answer voluminous emails, but in the most ideal circumstances, it sounds like it could be something that could be a great boon, and I want to thank you very much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Jennifer Christner. She's Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Associate Dean for Curriculum, and Dr. Neil Seidberg, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and the Chief Medical Informatics Officer at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.